We are getting started with part two of the case studies for CAT, and we're going to move into Maura's CWP and thyroid panel and her whole blood chemistry, and then we'll move into her adrenals, and she just forwarded us a hair analysis. We'll look at that as well and just see what we come up with. And just, I want, the whole purpose of this is not necessarily to come up with, you know, approaches for everybody that we have, although that would be great, and we will have some of that going on, but to really have you see the thought process of going through this. And the more you go through, the more you hear me going through, and the more you take yourself through. Like the question that Yvette asked just a little while ago. She asked about the testing for thyroid. Like she has a client in autoimmune, and what test should she do? Well, the thought process is, you know, we're thinking about thyroid. You go back to the thyroid module and say, okay, what were the recommended tests? What do we think is going on? We think there's an adrenal component. You always have to look at the adrenal component and the insulin component whenever you're looking at thyroid. They may or may not have those, but if they do have those, it's going to prevent the thyroid from getting better. So you have to address the adrenals. You have to address the insulin. So what are all the other factors? Somebody has an autoimmune condition. Big things, inflammation. You need to address inflammation. What are some of the nutrients that are important for inflammation? Well, fats. Right? Having the right essential fatty acids, the omega-3-6 balance, is it really super important for inflammation? As well as what else? Your B vitamins or minerals and a lot of the things that were listed as, remember, delta-6 desaturase. So as you go through these, you're going to be pulling it all together. Is it going to happen overnight? No. It's taken me many years to get to the point where I feel so fluent in this new language, so to speak, right? You start taking Spanish, and then you go to Mexico, and you're standing there going, blah, 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 blah. I hear a few words here and there, right? I get a few words here and there. That's how it might be for you right now with this whole lab analysis and case history analysis. Hopefully you're at the point where right away you can be looking at some of the lifestyle and diet things and see what stuff they're doing that's compromising them and help them with that. But we're here in this program because you want to take it a little bit deeper, right? You want to take it deeper for those people who are doing, you know, most of the time doing this stuff. Because a lot of people doing well most of the time, doing a good diet lifestyle most of the time is sufficient. For a lot of people, it's not, because there's a lot more biochemical disturbances underlying it. So what I've got on your screen is Maura's spreadsheet where she put all of her labs. She has a 6-14-12, 7-16-12, 3-24-11, 8-29-12, and 2-27-13. So she's got five different times that she did her labs, and she's reported them here. It's really helpful when you're working with somebody to get all of their stuff put on a spreadsheet, because then you can see sequentially what's been happening with that particular number, or if that particular parameter is missing. Looks like the only time that Maura did a complete blood analysis was 8-29-12. All of the others were very incomplete and very looking for specific things. It's really important to be more thorough when you're looking at these things, because sometimes just looking at a pattern, like what's happening with her BUN, you see it's yellow, meaning it's not in the optimal range. It's not in what's considered the pathological range, but it's lower than it should be. And we start to think of what can be going on with that. Now, had we had several iterations of that, we could either say, wow, her BUN has always been that low, so this is a problem she's had chronically. Let's try to figure out why. Or, wow, her BUN used to be higher, and now it's gone down. It's out of the optimal range, and what's causing that to happen? Or it used to be lower and it's getting better. So you may be looking at a number that looks out of range and you might be upset about it individually, but then you go, wow, she's getting better. So whatever she's doing is improving that. That's why it's really nice to have sequential measurements, especially the things that are out of range. And even the things that are not out of range, because if they start to go out of range, then you want to look at what stressors on the system are creating that out of range. So this is hers. I've spread it across. Now, if we want to see, well, what does that mean, you can see it. In addition to you being able to track your clients and yourself or your family members from one time to the next, you've got the ability to then have the little cheat sheet. Instead of having to pull out your manual to see what these things mean to refresh your memory, you can scroll across to the side. So, for example, she's got a BUN that's a little bit lower than we would like it to be. We have this CBC and chem and her thyroid and all this all in here. The very only time she did the full thing was 829. Her glucose looks fine. Her uric acid looks fine. Her BUN is a little bit below the normal range, the minimum range, I mean the ideal range, 13 to 18. She's at a 12. This is suggestive of, if we look across the column, malabsorption, liver dysfunction, or low protein diet. So that's where we ask Maura. We should open Maura up again, make sure she's available for us. Good. All right. So we want to ask Maura questions as we go along. I think Maura has her. Maura, could you mute your... So with Maura, low BUN, low creatinine, generally we're concerned pathologically for those if they tend to be high because that can indicate kidney problems and there's not a clearance as well as it should be. But with the low BUN and the low creatinine, it could be muscle wasting, malabsorption, liver dysfunction, low protein diet. So we'd be asking her about her protein intake and you could be doing a diet diary and looking to see if she's got enough. But because Maura has already expressed that she has such severe issues with her digestion, we're suspecting malabsorption to be what's going on with both of these. Now, the kind of follow-up you might want to do with this is to have her do an HCL challenge to see how her HCL is doing, and you have a description of how to do the HCL challenge, and if you don't, then go ahead and just do a web search on HCL challenge, and you'll find lots of good information on that. We want to optimize her digestion, which is what we're working on now, and make sure she's taking digestive enzymes. So if you're not taking digestive enzymes, Maura, go ahead and, you know, add those to your regime. I think I did see that on your list. And if you haven't done the HCL challenge, it would be a good thing to do. I know you're doing bitters to promote that, and bitters are great because it promotes the biliary movement as well. They're cholagogues as well, but it's also a good idea for the HCL and to help you with the digestion of protein. Sodium is normal, but her potassium is a little bit on the, let me widen that a little bit. Her potassium is a little bit above the range, quite a bit above the range. So she's either, when we look at what's going on with high potassium, hypoadrenal, which we're suspecting, we're going to look at that in a bit, dehydration or acidosis. So, Maura, if you're not already testing your pH first thing in the morning, go ahead and start testing your pH first thing in the morning. Your pH can go up as a result of sympathetic stress, meaning when you get stressed out, your pH is going to, go down. The acidity will go up. So you become more acid. So those are things to be looking at. So again, we're writing, as you're going through this case, I would have my little cheat sheet where I'm writing down, pH, let's look at that. You know, let's look at her HCL production, digestion, is she able to absorb things? And of course, adrenal, we've already made a note to look at her adrenal. So the first pass through, you're kind of gathering information because you don't have it all, and then you're going back and reading it with a new eye when you have more information. Given her sodium is at the lower end of normal, and with low sodium, it is often an indication of hypoadrenal. It's yet another use, but also laxative use. But she's not really showing abnormals there. So we're going to keep going down. We notice that the carbon dioxide is okay, and carbon dioxide is usually out of range. It's usually low, when there's acidosis. So that may not be the issue as per the potassium. And I would also ask her about potassium supplements. Is she taking a lot of potassium? And she may be overtaking the potassium. Her protein is low. The protein is outside the optimal range. Is it outside the pathological range? No, but it also, look at BUN, creatinine, and protein. And all of those are suggested of either a low protein diet or malabsorption hypochlorhydria. So these are things we want to be looking at for sure. And then we go down, scroll down, the albumin, globulin is okay, but her alk phosphatase is 58. It's low. Now, we don't know if it's low and it used to be high, or it used to be high and now it's low, but low alkaline phosphatase, if we look across, can have to do with estrogen dominance, right? And let's make a big note of that one, because estrogen dominance can affect thyroid. B6 deficiency or zinc deficiency, again, malabsorption, and hypothyroid or adrenal. So we know she has hypothyroid. We're suspicious of the adrenals. We haven't looked at her tests yet, but we're very suspicious of adrenals. We're also very suspicious of malabsorption. So now we're looking at B6 and zinc. So we're writing those things down as possibilities for us to explore. Okay? And then we look at our next number, which is LDH, which is extremely low. It's 83 on a range of ideal 140 to 180 and on the normal lab range 89 to 215. What does that usually mean? Hypoglycemia is very common with LDH being low. It can have something to do with the B6 and zinc, not as much as the alkaline phosphatase, but looking at hypoglycemia. So Maura may be having a lot of spells of low blood sugar, which when she says she has a hard time making it from dinner till bedtime, says maybe she is having some blood sugar issues that are expressing as hypoglycemia. So this is, again, putting in the list of blood sugar issues, and blood sugar issues can affect the thyroid. So we're trying to pull it together. We're trying to create a picture here, okay? And then the rest of her numbers are normal. They don't test iron. I don't know why many labs, many docs' offices don't do iron anymore. Some of them don't do iron or ferritin, but some opt to just do ferritin. I kind of think it's a good idea to have both so that we know what the blood circulating levels of iron are and what the storage of iron is, so we can tell if there's an issue with the liver and with the storage, the enzymes that do storage. Her cholesterol numbers are nice, reasonable. Triglycerides are extremely low, 26. 26, that suggests fat malabsorption or a low-fat diet, and I don't think she's on a low-fat diet. I know she doesn't have hyperthyroid, but also an autoimmune condition and hyperadrenals. And so we're looking again at adrenals, we're looking again at malabsorption, but in this particular case, we're looking at fat, which, remember, we mentioned earlier the suspicion of liver and gallbladder related to the constipation. So this is something we want to be looking at. Her HDLs are very good at 98. Her triglyceride HDL ratio is not in the risk of insulin resistance. So Maura is definitely not insulin resistant. She's more towards hypoglycemia, but because her ratio, and her ratio of HDL, triglyceride HDL, is like 0.3 or 0.4 even, which is very, very low. I mean, 0.25. Okay, and high cholesterol is usually a hallmark of low thyroid function, and she's not showing that. So we're going to look and see what's going on here. Her TSH, I'm going to change that so it's easier to read, is less than 0.1, less than 0.1, and that's definitely low, outside of the lab range as well as outside of the optimal range. And it's a little bit better in this one, but not significantly. And here's, again, less than 0.15. It's pretty consistent. 0.015, yeah. So really, really, really low TSH. What this means is she's over-medicated. Her pituitary is basically shut down. It's no longer stimulating the thyroid because she's taking in a lot of thyroid. And now some doctors will say that that's okay to be that low. There's really an ideal range, even on medication, at least 0.3, and the ideal is generally considered to be 1.8 or 1.5 in the Karazian system, which we talked about last week, and that could be indicating, remember we had some issues that you could have hypothyroid related to the pituitary or the hypothalamus. So we'll have to look and see what's going on with that. Usually that's associated with low T4, which she doesn't have, though. So we do have some issues here with the TSH. We're thinking, let's just see if she's over-medicated. All right. So the dates are, let's see. So back in 6-12, 6 2012, as well as 8/2012. She's got very low function, and then still all the way through till November of this year, February of this year, she's low. And let's look. Her thyroxin is 7.7 and 8.3, which is pretty decent, healthy levels since she's on the medication that's providing that. She's not making it herself. It's really clear she's not making it herself. Total T3, the triiodothyronine is total T3. She had a 121 before. Now she has a 136. It's not really a 136. She just probably did it at a different lab, which instead of recording it as nanograms per deciliter, provided it as picograms. So we're going to just change that to 136, which puts her total T3 in the normal range. What that says is that there's some balance between T4 and T3. She's taking it, and she's in the kind of middle range for both of them. So that's probably from the Armour thyroid. Now, the free T3 and the free T4 have to do with how well does she unbind, how well does she take the thyroid hormone out of the protein-bound state and put it in the free state that can be used by her tissue. So her free T4 has gone down. It was 1.1, now it's 1.13 and 1.14, so it's close to the bottom of the range. It used to be right there in the middle, so something's happening to make it go down. And also we noticed that her TSH has gone down as well, so we might ask her if there's been a change in the level of medication between here and there. But the free T3, remember, is the unbound from the protein. Part of that gets picked up by the cells at the receptor level, but most of that gets converted to free T3. Some of that gets converted to reverse T3. Her free T3 is really high back last August. We don't know what that is now, so I would love to see what that is now. But based on what we're seeing here, she's either taking too much in the form of the medication, or she is over-converting, or she is got too little of the binding globulin and too much of it is free. It's actually the opposite of what I would expect with an insulin dominance, an estrogen dominance. So if we look over on the side, if you want a cheat sheet version of it, we have an elevated free T3, which is usually seen in hyperthyroid. I want to ask Maura if she's noticing things like heart palpitations, like this kind of overactivity.
No, I haven't.
You haven't noticed any kind of signs that would indicate like rapid heartbeat or anything like that, panic attacks?
No, I did go from my medication at 180, and then I dropped it down to 150.
When was that?
That was these more recent lab results should show that I changed.
Okay, but you didn't get the free T3 checked, so hopefully that came down, but we don't know that for sure.
Right, I don't know why he didn't order that one.
I don't know. Yeah, so that would be one I would be looking at to make sure that this thing is, that at least in the blood, the numbers look okay. So then
okay.
We look at, you're showing a lot of hypothyroid signs, and yet your numbers look pretty good as far as we can tell here. What's going on? And that gets back to the whole receptor thing. And if you remember from last week, do you remember some of the things that can affect the receptors?
Yeah, I was just going to look that up and check.
Okay, go look that up.
Okay.
And then I'm going to have you read some of those to people. So because in you reading them out, that's going to reinforce to you and help you with what your next steps need to be.
Yeah, keep moving along. I'll pull out.
Okay. So we have white blood cells. They're a little bit low. They look like they've gotten better from March 11 to August 12. Would have been nice to see them again this time. We tend to see those be a little bit on the low side, a lot on the low side sometimes when somebody has an autoimmune disease. It's either a chronic infection or an autoimmune disease. And so she may have a chronic gut infection, which could be very likely, and I remember doing one of the tests and we found a couple of organisms there. That would be worth rechecking after you go through the leaky gut protocol and the candida protocol again. But she's basically got something that's a chronic stress on her immune system because it's keeping her white blood cells a little bit low. So it could be the autoimmune, which means there might be some other autoimmunity going on since the ANAs are showing up okay, or it could be a gut infection or some sort of an infection that's hidden somewhere. Her red blood cells look good. She doesn't have signs of iron deficiency anemia here. Let's see, this is hematocrit. And she said listed as, HCT is another way. She writes that it's listed as HCT. So 40.3 listed as HCT. HCT, if you see it on the lab, HCT is the same as hematocrit. So we'll just take that part out so that it shows up as a good number. Okay? We do see, though, that she's a little bit lower here in 2013 than she was before. So we want to keep an eye on that. We don't have the hemoglobin there, and we don't have the red blood cell count for that date. So we can't really compare, but that to me says, she's going in the wrong direction. Next time she gets this checked, I want a full panel with a full CBC, not just hematocrit. I'm not sure what their thinking was to just do hematocrit on you, unless you just got those numbers in the wrong columns. That might be the case, too.
Sorry, I'm not sure.
Okay. So MCV, remember MCV is the size of your red blood cells, right? So if they're too small, it's a microcytic anemia, and that has to do with iron deficiency. If they're too large, it has to do with a macrocytic anemia, and some of the possible causes of that would be deficiency of folic acid or deficiency of vitamin B12. Those can be caused by hypochlorhydria. There can also be a heavy metal issue that can contribute to that, as well as vitamin C deficiency. So we'll take a look at her hair analysis to see if she has any heavy metal stuff going on. MCH, related to the MCV, it's a ratio that's taken. So we're looking at the B12 folic anemia as a possibility here. We have the RDW. RDW is probably the most sensitive indicator for some sort of anemia. It's not specific at all, but it's very sensitive. Certain things are sensitive but not specific, and certain things are specific but not very sensitive. And so what this means is that the RDW being elevated means that there's a variation in the size of your red blood cells. And that generally means that there's some sort of underlying anemia going on, but it could be a combined anemia. So the RDW will pick it up. If your MCV looks perfectly normal, you could have both an iron deficiency anemia and a B12 or folate anemia going on at the same time. One is making the blood cells larger. The other one's making them smaller. How you know if there's an anemia in that case is if the RDW is abnormal. And if the RDW is a little bit elevated, it means that it's the average, the red cell width is actually distribution is larger than it should be. So there's more variation in those sizes. So she's definitely got some sort of anemia going on based on the numbers I saw. And I peeked ahead and saw that her ferritin used to be good anyway. It's most likely related to B12 folic acid. Now, if we go further down, we see that her neutrophils are a little on the high side, and her monocytes are a little on the high side, and eosinophils. What does all that mean? Well, what that means for monocytes is that she may be in a stage, either an acute or healing stage of an illness. So I would be going back and saying, well, this is, oh, wow, that's way back when. I'm not even going to think about that one because we're looking at the 2011. They didn't do it again, which is very strange. But that's certainly something worth doing again, is to do a complete comprehensive wellness profile with a complete CBC with differential. So, well, I see what they did. They did a CBC, but they didn't do it with differential. Let me explain that. They did the white blood cell count. They did the red blood cell count, and they did the hemoglobin and the hematocrit and all. But when you ask for it with differential, that means that you want to see how the distribution of those white blood cells are. And as I recall, maybe she didn't even get the white blood cells done. Yeah, no, she did get the white blood cells done. They were 3.6, which they were better than they were before back in 11. So I'm not even going to look at that, but I will explain to you what those things mean just as a refresher. So she's got elevated monocytes will often indicate that there's an acute and healing, she's in the acute or healing recovery phase of an illness. So if somebody had just gotten over a cold or a flu, you will oftentimes see the monocytes up. It can also indicate liver problems. So that's something we want to be looking at because we're suspicious of her liver related to her constipation. Okay? And we're not concerned about prostate, which is the other thing that's listed there because she doesn't have one. With eosinophils can be high with parasites or allergy. Now, since her basophils are low, it probably suggests the eosinophils are a little high because of allergy, not parasites, because usually the basophils will get elevated when there's parasites going on. Okay, and she did a homocysteine, and her homocysteine is elevated. That is another confirmation to me that there's an issue going on with B12 and folic acid. She's got really good levels of cholesterol, but you are predisposed to cardiac problems when your homocysteine is elevated. She's got a 12. Her most recent one is a 12, which says to me there's some issues with her B12 folic acid. Now, it's possible that Mara has some methylation issues going on with the genetics. You know, you've heard us talk about this a few times before on calls, and that we'll talk much more detail about that when we do the nutrigenomics section. But when there's methylation issues, you can do a blood level of B12 or folic acid, and it shows up just fine because it's not looking at the active form, the methylated form. And when you have issues with the methylated forms of those, you're going to see an elevated homocysteine. B6 is another thing that causes an elevation in homocysteine. And we saw that with the low alk-phos that she may have a B6 issue. So the three things I'm looking at here are B6, B12, and folic acid. And she may say, but I'm taking B vitamins, may not be taking enough. And if she's taking substantial levels of B vitamins but not seeing these numbers improve, then what's happening is that she most likely or possibly has some sort of a genetic thing that's causing her to not be methylating these properly. They may not be the right forms of these nutrients, right? She may not be taking in the right form of B12 or folic acid. So we want to look at, when they say they're taking B vitamins, ask them to read. So for Mora, I want to know, what are the forms of B12 and folic acid that you're taking? You said you're taking B vitamins. Are you there?
Yes. I've actually, the B12, I've done the patch, the B12 patch.
Okay.
And I've B12 shots.
Wow. And how often have you done the patches or the shots?
I've done the patch probably, it depends on when I'm feeling more fatigued. I'll do it like maybe 3 times a week.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least once a week.
Okay.
And I've had 3 B12 shots now in the past 3 months.
Okay. So this is since this test? This test was, 2 months ago. Okay, so some were before and some were after the test was done. Okay. All right. And then what about folic acid?
That I'm doing as a capsule supplement.
And what's the form?
That's a good question. I'll have to check.
Okay. So you want to look at the form of the folic acid. Do not use synthetic folic acid. It should be 5-methyl tetrahydrofolic acid. It's methylated folate.
Okay, that I know I'm not.
Okay. Now, some of the supplement combinations do have that, but it is rare. Most of the combinations, either the multivitamin or the B complex, will be not the methylated form. So that's the thing to check, because if she's taking, she's taking B12 in the proper form, the patches are methylated, the shots, you want to look to see if they were methylated or not. Generally, they give methylated shots. And even when they don't, because it's such a high amount, oftentimes it bypasses some of the methylation issues, but maybe not. So we'd want to look at what the form of those shots were. And if they're not methylated, ask your doctor to do methyl B12 shots. And then for the folate, 5-methyltetrahydrofolic acid. Foreign has a really nice product for that. It's a capsule. I like theirs the best. There's also one from Metagenics, which is a tablet. I'm not crazy about tablets, especially with people with digestive issues, because I don't trust that the tablets are going to get broken down in a compromised digestive tract. If you really want to make sure that the methylated folate gets in, you can open it up, the powder, and put it in a liquid and take it in liquid form as well. They're also a company that does sell liquid, and I don't know the name of the company. Somebody mentioned it to me a little while ago. So you may just look up liquid form of methylated folate, 5-methyltetrahydrofolic acid. C-reactive protein is not an issue. That's great, because oftentimes that's compromised in an autoimmune flare-up. Hemoglobin A1C is perfect. It's a 5. Ferritin 56 is just fine. It used to be a little bit lower back in 2011, but now it's fine. And what do we have? The vitamin B6, I'm going to change that to 61 because we don't need to. It's listed as dihydroxy. That's how it's usually listed. And she had a 61, which is a little bit on the low end. So if you aren't taking D, it's really important for your thyroid function to have that D in the optimal range, which I like to see 75 to 180. You know, that kind of range, okay, 90 even. So whatever you're doing on your D, I would up it a little bit. How much D do you know how much you're taking? Do you know how much D you're taking, Maura?
D, yes, I was doing the D shot and take 5,000 milligrams a day.
5,000 a day? And you're at 61. Why don't you up that to something like 8,000 a day?
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
Okay. And what I would recommend is, based on some of the things we come up with here, is to at least get the complete blood panel done in 3 months from now, just to see how everything's doing.
Okay.
Okay? Including that free T3.
Okay.
Okay, so those are the things we're finding in her blood. As a recap, we've got malabsorption. So there's some issues going on. We want her to look at her digestive enzymes and HCL. And is she getting enough protein? Is really realistically looking, is she getting enough protein in addition to, is she absorbing enough protein? So those are the two issues with that. That's with the protein, the bun, and the creatinine. The alk phos, and also getting the homocysteine, we're looking at vitamin B6. So are you taking B6? And if you're not, I would recommend the P5P version of B6, and I would have you take 50 milligrams per day.
Okay.
Okay. Just to be safe, since there's two indicators, plus your sleep, you know, sleep stuff, which you have under control with the melatonin and the 5-HTP, but just to make sure. In terms of the thyroid, did you get that list? Can you read us that list?
No, you know what? I'm sorry. I was trying to listen, and I didn't have it right where I thought I had it, so I'm sorry. I don't.
Okay. So I'll just spew them out. A few of the things that can cause problems with the thyroid resistance. Number one is adrenals, and we're going to look at her adrenal test in a bit and see what she needs to be doing to support that adrenal. But when you have excess cortisol, it causes the receptors to burn out. It damages them. If you have too little cortisol, they can't function properly. So it really has to be just the right amount of cortisol in order for the receptors to work properly. Okay. Vitamin A is another piece that's important for those receptors. Vitamin A. And while on a high plant-based diet, you're eating a lot of beta-carotene, it's kind of a catch-22, because when your thyroid isn't functioning properly, you don't really convert the beta-carotene as efficiently to vitamin A as you would. But then your vitamin, in order to get good thyroid function, you need the vitamin A. So you may look at a preformed vitamin A. My favorites are micellized, a liquid micellized vitamin A, if you can find it. Okay? And just take maybe 5,000 IUs per day. And if you find a good micellized version of it, 5,000 IUs is just a single drop.
Okay.
Okay? Very simple, very easy, but that would cover those bases. All right. What else for the receptors? Anybody else want to pipe in with the receptors? What am I forgetting? We don't have testosterone and we don't have estrogen. Good point. But I think on one of her other tests, we do have the, at least the estrogen. So we'll take a look at that. And Michaeline, would you like to, are you on the line? Can you explain to people why you're thinking testosterone? That would be great.
But what about things like stress and an anti-inflammatory diet, you know, staying away
right,
from the
right, right. Yes, so stress we already talked about, right, with the adrenal. The inflammatory, you know, her CRP is okay, so I'm not as concerned that that's an issue, that but certainly the fats and the anti-inflammatory are a good point, right, the omega-3s, yes?
Yes, so I was thinking about the testosterone because in terms of the on their her free T3, it was high.
Yep.
And so I was thinking about the possible overconversion. And she does have a testosterone result that's high, very high, although it's blood, back in, what was it, 2012.
I didn't make it that far down. There we go. Ah, she does have a high testosterone level. Interesting. That would be worth looking at. Well, I don't know, Maura, if that was tested in the panel that you sent with this test, but we'll take a look at that. But, yeah, high testosterone can cause that overconversion. But that would not explain Maura's hypothyroid symptoms, which is kind of, you know, it's kind of confounding, right, because she's not having any hyperthyroid symptoms that you would expect with overconversion. So before we even do anything to see what that is, I would want to see a more up-to-dated T3 because they did change her medication levels, and it might have been just that she was taking in too much with the armor. And sometimes people, you know, I know armor is a natural form, nature thyroid is a natural form, it's from bovine, but some people do better when they actually do the bioidenticals of the thyroid where there's a specific amount of T3 and a specific amount of T4, and when they're changing and altering the medication, they can up or down either T3 or T4, so they could change the ratio. But if you're taking armor or nature thyroid, you're stuck with whatever that ratio is, and it may not be the ratio for you. And a lot of docs don't like to use armor because they find that it overstimulates their people. Again, you may not remember back to then to see if you were having any heart palpitations or any kinds of problems with hyperthyroid back then, but most of the problems you're showing are related more to hypo, right, but good points. Thank you. Thanks for pointing that out, and it's really good to be looking at all these different things. And I'm looking at her antibodies, and her antibodies were less than 10 and less than 20, which puts them in the, we don't know how much less it was. I like them to be zero, but she's definitely not showing up in the lab range as having a problem with antibodies. But again, worth repeating, and say 3 months, let's come up with something for you to be doing for the next 3 months and then redo the whole test, including the full thyroid panel. Let me see what else I might have missed down below because I think I stopped after seeing the B12. Her serum B12 is showing up as greater than 1,500. And she has been taking it, but she has that high MCV. So either the high MCV is strictly due to the folate and the B12 is fine indeed because, after all, she is taking some of the methylated forms, or she just doesn't have the right form and it's not being able to be used by the tissue. And the high homocysteine says to us that it's either B12, B6, or folic acid. And it could be all of them, but it just may be the B6 and the folic acid, or it may just be the folic acid. So since she's not taking the methylated form of the folic acid, that's the one that I would say, let's switch to the methylated form of folic acid. And I would take a substantial dose if we're going to test this out. You can't get into trouble by taking, say, 2 or 3 grams a day of methylated folate. If you take too little, you may retest and find out that it's not much different because you weren't taking enough, especially if you do have that genetic thing. By the way, based on both Michaeline and Deborah's recommendations, I checked out the 23andMe, and we'll talk more about that when we do the nutrigenomics, but it's well worth $99 to get the genetic testing done. And I would highly recommend that you do that, more given all the situations you have, because that'll give maybe more information on things that we could we could change. So we go back. These are old tests, like from last year, so almost a year ago, 6/14/12. We had progesterone in the kind of lowish end of range, and again, it's blood, high testosterone, high free testosterone, FSH. Wow, it's interesting. If FSH is less than 0.2, FSH is usually elevated in menopause. So that's kind of interesting. And we don't know what the estrogens are, but estradiol is the only one they measured. I'm not a big fan of just measuring blood levels of those hormones because they're static. They're usually protein bound, and it doesn't really give us an indication of what's really happening in your tissues. But one of her other tests shows the estrogen in the form of the saliva. What stage? How about let's do more of yourself. What stage, based on what you've learned about staging of adrenals, what stage are you in according to this test?
I was thinking stage 3.
Tell me why.
Because of the decreased DHEA levels.
Okay. So let's review. Anybody have any other ideas? Raise your hand if you have another thought on the staging for Maura.
Okay. I would think when I looked at it, it's not as bad as I thought it would look, but I would say more of a stage 2.
Yep. That's what I would say. Yeah, Maura. Because if you were a stage 1, your numbers would be below the range. And although your first morning one is at the very low end of the normal range, I would have liked to see that higher, which could explain why you're more fatigued in the morning. But all of them are within that range, and your total cortisol load is 30. So again, it's more towards the little bit towards the lower end, but still within the normal range. What this means is that your adrenals aren't completely burned out. You've got some reserves, but because your DHEA is 1, means you've been in this state for a really long time, a really long time. Probably having a lot of preceding this was a lot of high cortisol levels and cortisol spikes, and my guess is that you have these little cortisol spikes throughout the day when stressful things happen and you get upset about things, that you're having these spikes that are draining your reserves and causing a lot of your pregnenolone to get converted to cortisol and not enough to DHEA. So it's been going on for a while. It is a stage 2, and you've got to get some work done on this. Now, you mentioned earlier that you had been taking, and this was back in September, so we'll go back and look at your more recent one before we make a decision what you should do. But at that time is when I had told you about DHEA and pregnenolone and taking those, but we didn't redo them. So you should have been staying on those until such time as redoing a test to see where the test results are. You had 2 extra vials, but you didn't run those. Let's see. Your progesterone is also depressed, and your salivary IgA just confirms that this is a chronic problem, right? A chronic problem. So more of your precursor pregnenolone is being converted down to cortisol at the expense of progesterone, DHEA, and probably at the expense of some of the other hormones, and we'll look at that on your other test, your more recent test. The salivary IgA, again, it's not as bad as I've seen, so that's a good sign. But again, that can be contributing to your problems in your gut and possibly some gut overgrowth type things.
While you're pulling that up, Deborah had an interesting point that she notated on the chat, saying that make certain to take methyl B12 before the methylfolate to avoid methyl trapping.
Yes, she's been taking. That's why I recommended going right to the folate, because she's been getting shots and she's been doing the patch. So she has been taking the methyl.
So Deborah's saying to actually, when you're taking your supplements, to take the B12 before you take the B.
In terms of the sequencing. Okay, you got that, Maura? That's a good point. Thank you, Deborah.
Yes, it's important, the sequencing, as well as in Maura's case, since she has a history of not being absolutely consistent in taking things, I think it would be just good to point that, you know, to make a point of hitting that topic with her.
Of taking what again, please?
Well, she has a history of maybe taking supplements and then maybe dropping off of some supplements. And so if she understands that it's important to make certain that if you're taking the methylfolate, to be taking the B12 and to take the B12 before, then she might be more consistent in.
Right. No, that's a great point. That's a really great point. Because that's, you know, yes, she's taking it, but if she misses it on days or she takes them out of order. So, okay, great point. Great point. So did you get that, Maura? Do you understand that?
Yeah, kind of, that you should take the B12 before taking any of the other Bs.
Yeah, you might, well, before taking the folate, you might get a sublingual B12 and that
okay.
You can take that sublingual methyl B12 before you take your methylated folate.
Okay.
Just
or
because the others are you don't take them daily, and this might be helpful for you to take it daily along with your folate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Right. Okay? So you're going to take the methylated B12, get some drops. They're easy to find. Methyl B-folate drops under the tongue, and then you take it. You take the folate.
And then you take the folate.
Do you know,
okay.
Is there a specific timing there, Deborah? Like, length of time between?
You know what? Not that I've discovered, but I have not read that there's any specific time frame, but they say take it before. So I, in my own personal case, I'm taking it in a pretty compact time.
Okay.
I'm not
so
doing
like 10,
one
5, 10
and
minutes
one,
away
and
or
and
just right late. After?
Yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Okay.
So if I discover anything else, I'll let everyone know.
Got it. Deborah's been doing a lot of research into this methylation stuff. So,
what if we were to take the B12 alone at some other time away from these supplements, other supplements that we take, Deborah?
That's fine.
Okay.
The B12 is fine. It's when you're taking the methylfolate, you want to make certain you've taken B12 before that so that it doesn't have this methyl trapping effect.
But
okay.
It should be relatively close proximity. My feeling.
Yes, that's what that's the way that I I'm taking it.
Right.
Even though it's not really, they don't document an actual time.
Like how much time?
Right.
So take it, and then maybe 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, take the B12, the folate.
Exactly. That's what I've been doing. That's how I interpreted it.
Right. And if it's patch, if you're wearing a patch one day, you can put the patch on, and then you can go ahead and take your folate after that, and the patch will be slowly absorbed. Unless that's not enough, maybe you're better off taking the full dose.
I don't know about the patch and how quickly that's absorbed, so I couldn't really respond.
Yeah, well, it's drip fed over 24 hours. So, probably better off getting a sublingual B12, methylated B12, take that, and then 5-10 minutes later take your folic acid, your methylated folic acid.
I think that would be the safest.
Yeah.
Okay.
You got it?
Thank you, guys.
Oh, you're welcome. So if we look at Maura's stool test, this we did during the digestive, but we look through it. She had normal flora after 24 hours. Okay, so she had a Citrobacter. So she does have a bacterial thing abundantly growing in her gut. She's also got a Blastocystis hominis. So that whole thing we said about the eosinophils and basophils, that it probably wasn't a parasite. Indeed, that was wrong. So just because both of them are not elevated, just the eosinophils alone can mean that there's a parasite. So she has parasite. She has an overgrowth of Citrobacter, and she's got the rest of it is clear. Okay? So here's what happened, though, when we first started her on an anti-parasite protocol. As I recall, you started getting even more bloated, right? You felt worse.
Mm-hmm.
Probably what that was die-off reaction, what's called the Herxheimer reaction. Yeah, yeah. So she was getting a Herxheimer reaction from her body turning, killing off, and the cell walls are bursting from these bacteria and parasites, and they're releasing their toxins. So what that means is that going back onto that protocol, but moving very, very slowly through it would be beneficial. Because if you're working on your leaky gut right now, but you don't get rid of the parasites and the bacteria that are growing there, then you're going to have an issue. And I know, I think the one that I had recommended you do was the tricycline.
Yeah.
Because it covered both the bacteria and the parasites, the stuff that had berberine and artemisia in it.
Uh-huh.
Did you ever go back and finish that stuff, or do you still have it sitting on your shelf?
Yeah, no, I did one whole month of that. I finished everything.
You did. So you went back to do that again, and when was that?
That was back in November.
Okay. So and it didn't cause you the extra bloating and all when you went back?
Right, not when I went back. And then I just followed up with a whole bottle of Scram, just because I kind of wanted to make 100% sure it was gone.
Okay. So the way that we know if it's 100% sure gone is to redo the test.
Okay.
You don't have to do the one with the H. pylori, because the H. pylori, it costs more and it was negative. But I would definitely recommend redoing this.
Okay. And so which test is this?
This was the BioHealth.
Okay.
And I think the way we had you do that was just, I think we ordered it for you, because we don't have this up on the website yet. I'm not sure. Go to drreedemarie.com/lab testing and see if it's up there yet. And if it's not, well, just shoot me an email and let me know, and I'll tell Scott to order it for you. But he's had to order it individually so many times, I'd be surprised if he hasn't already gotten it on the website, because it's much easier.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so check the website, drreedemarie.com/lab testing, and if that doesn't work, then go ahead and shoot an email to Scott and tell them that we were speaking and you want to order the BioHealth 401 test.
Okay, and so that's without the H. pylori,
without
right?
The H. pylori, the 401. Yeah, 401H has the H. pylori, and make sure you say it's the 401, not the 401H.
Okay.
Okay? And then we could order that for you, and you can take care of it, and we'll see how this is going. And if it's still stuff, because usually it takes, especially with somebody like you with years and years of stuff, it's like, it's try it, work on it for a while, maybe takes more than 1 month, one round. It may take two or three.
Oh, okay.
All right. So let's see where you are now, and then go from there.
Okay.
Okay? Yeah, so gut imbalances. This could be related to the low white blood cell count, definitely related to the eosinophils, and can be related to a lot of the issues that she's having in her gut. And it's going to keep the leaky gut from repairing, because the bacterial toxins are aggravating and irritating and inflaming those walls. Okay?
So parasite cleansing is necessary to do then before a gut healing, then?
If you've got any stuff, and if you don't know about it, then it's certainly good to do either concurrent with it, or usually what I'll do is have people do the two concurrently if they're not real sensitive. Like the 30 days I laid out with ERC, had the both done. You started with the leaky gut, then you went into the parasite cleanse, and then continue on another month of the leaky gut. Just depends on the extent of it, right? If we're trying to do it without doing testing, then that's the protocol I'd probably follow. But then for most people, it goes better. And then if it's not getting better, then it's worthwhile spending the $300 or $250 to get the testing done. All right, so let's look at, that was that. And this was 318. So this is only a month old, okay? So we're looking at her adrenal graph. And it looks like they have a different scale, because unless they're just doing units one. But if you look at the lines, the lower one and the high one, what she's got is still super low in the morning, like she was before. And then she's going high at night, which is what I had suspected initially. Now, Maura, what I would ask you here is, have you noticed a reoccurrence of any of the sleep issues more recently? Before doing this test or while you were doing this test?
No, just that I'm waking up, still feeling tired in the morning.
Right, but no more problems with falling asleep.
No, I'm still just, again, with the melatonin and the 5-HTP.
Right. Right.
Then I seem to be able to fall asleep.
Okay. So, again, this is a different lab. I usually like to do the same labs when I repeat them, but that's okay. We'll figure it out. So her cortisol levels, so she's at the low end of normal when she first gets up. They don't even show a graph here, so I kind of like my test that I get used to.
I know. I don't like this one at all. I'm sorry.
Like
it was just.
Yeah. But
so
what we're seeing is that she's starting
to
go out of range. Yeah.
I want to redo the other one. Once I saw this one come through, I was like, oh, bummer.
Yeah, it's just not as nicely laid out and all. But anyway, she's high at the dinner time and she's high at bedtime. So, looking at what's going on here, hard to say. Let's see. Let me see the rest of it. So the DHA has gotten better, maybe, because, again, it's a different range, and I don't know how to relate this range, because if I look at the range that diagnostics says is okay, their kind of average range was something like 3 or 4 to 10, and the ideal really is 7 to 10. And so she was at a 1. So she was below that ideal range. And now with this, she's in the ideal range, but not by much. The ideal, the range here they're giving is 57 to 615, and she's only 191. So she's in the lower third of that range. Range rate change, effective 611. I don't know because I haven't done these tests, this particular one before. So it looks like it's better, but still at the low end, and it could be boosted up a bit. Estradiol, again, so she's got the estradiol and estrone, but not the estriol, so we really can't do the estrogen quotient without that. Her estradiol is at the lower end. Her estrone is at the lower end, which is consistent with menopause. And let's see. Oh, yeah, menopause, 1 to 8, and she's still at the low end of menopause, 0.5 to 1.7. She's at the middle range, or at the, no, she's more at the low end. Progesterone, 74.5, menopause, anywhere from 19 to 106. So her progesterone looks okay here, and her testosterone, 65.1, female. Testosterone is more towards the higher side of the range for females, but not out of range. So did you follow any of the directions here? Do you do any of these supplements of theirs? This is neuroscience, and they have their own tests. The reason I like to do tests that give us generic recommendations as opposed to specific to a specific company. And my reasoning for that is that I don't always necessarily use that company, and I'd like to know what the specific recommendations are so we could use generic and we could choose our own formulas. So I have a hard time with these, especially with some of their formulas, the neuroscience formulas. They all say, proprietary blend of, and they give you the list of nutrients. Well, you don't know how much of everything is in each one. But what they're basically saying is Adricor, I don't know why they would discontinue the use of CompRT. CompRT contains phosphatidylserine. They're changing it to a different COM, and I'm not familiar with their formulas. So, but basically, they're putting you on phosphatidylserine starting 30 minutes before dinner and then before bedtime. Yeah, so the Adricor they're recommending is the tyrosine, rhodiola, and methionine along with B3, the CompRT, CompCP. Here we go. Yeah, at this point, you know, I would recommend that you stick with what's working for the sleep at this point and go back to the pregnenolone DHEA. We'll treat you in a stage two. This is kind of, if you added this total up, you're still a stage two because this is a low, this is high. Your balance is still going to be total in the stage two. I would recommend the DHEA, 3 drops, 3 times a day.
Okay.
The pregnenolone, let's say 10 drops 3 times a day.
Okay.
And then I would redo the ASI test in 3 months and just continue that protocol for 3 months. I would recommend that you do the gut test soon so you could see how much effect you've had with what you've done so far and what needs to still be done. And then, like we said, about the vitamin D and the other things we recommended on the other test, and then get that one done 2 to 3 months. The complete panel with the complete thyroid, with the complete CBC.
Okay.
All right. And then looking at this stuff, liver and gallbladder do come up. So those herbs that I had recommended, I don't know if you started those, but you had taken them when you were here. What were they? Was there Don Quai?
The yellow duck and Don Quai.
Yellow duck and Don Quai. Yeah. And those, and Celadon. Those things are going to help with the liver. So you can, I can't remember if they were powder or if they were tea form, like little leaves, but you can make a tea with those. And you can use that tea as a basis for an elixir. And then you can add to the elixir your maca, your astragalus, whatever other adrenal herbs, ashwagandha. You can add those to it as well. And do one of those every day. That might be a great thing for you to do. Well, no, that's too late in the day. I was going to say that might be a great thing for you to do at 6:30 so to prevent you from getting too hungry at bedtime. But you'd have to just put the non-stimulating stuff. You could probably do it with the yellow dock, the Dawn Quai, the Celandine, and ashwagandha. Yeah, you could do it that way.
Okay.
I might leave the maca off at night. Might be too stimulating. But you could certainly try that, and that's a good way to get all of that in you and also prevent you from getting those heebie-jeebie hungers at 8 o'clock. Okay?
All right.
I'm going to look just at the heavy metals but because I don't want to go into an explanation of all the others until we do our thing because that could take an hour. No lead, no mercury, no cadmium, arsenic, a little bit of aluminum. Tiny bit of nickel, tiny bit of cobalt, tiny bit of molybdenum, lithium, boron. I don't see the heavy metals as being huge. I'd want to know what the source of. Nickel can be from dental fillings or caps or crowns. That underlying metal on crowns is usually nickel. The rest of it is really very tiny amounts, except for the aluminum. So you may want to look at sources of aluminum. Are you doing any deodorants that contain aluminum and antiperspirants that contain aluminum? Cooking in aluminum cookware, and look at products, any kind of hair care or products that you use for sources of aluminum.
Okay.
Okay. I would say with this little bit of level, just things like making sure you do some chlorella on a regular basis. Sea vegetables, they could be chelating. I don't think you have to do anything major to do chelation because the numbers are so low.
Okay.
Okay.
Chat going on about the estrogen quotient from Yvette. Let me get down there. How to calculate the estrogen.
Yeah, you can't do it without the estriol. So that's what I just said at the end, is that what I would recommend is that she handle the stuff we know about already and then do the 24-hour urine test and see what's left, if there's anything out of balance at that point. Iodine could be helpful at this point because you've got thyroid, you are doing sea vegetables. You could consider an iodine supplement. I just want to make sure that you don't already have excessive iodine before we do that. Remember we talked about the problems that you can get into with excessive iodine. So I would say keep on with your sea vegetables at this point, and then let's see where it goes. You could also consider the iodine loading test as well.
Oh, okay.
We talked about that, and you can look that up and contact those labs and see about getting that. Mycala, the one that Zita had recommended, is like $99. So it's not an expensive test and certainly worth doing before supplementing with iodine. Oh, Bridget's trying to understand why I recommended the adaptogens, blood sugar herbs, trying to understand suggestion. It's just that I had recommended for early on, I had said to Maura that because she tends to get hungry at 8:30-ish, to really be looking at her dinner, but also to check in with herself at about 6:30-ish so that she still has the 3 hours. And doing so I just said about the iodine loading test. So we were talking about that, Bridget. That's a great question. And it wasn't specifically to intervene with the blood sugar. I mean, I think what happens with Maura, she doesn't eat enough at her evening meal. She tends to feed the rest of the family and gets distracted and doesn't eat enough and then finds herself hungry later. So I was asking her to, since we want to get some of these other herbs in her, to take that time about an hour after dinner is to make that elixir and have that in anticipation, and that would cut some of those blood sugar issues down, you know, cut some of the hunger down. And homocysteine, I did mention a couple of times. I also mentioned the ways to address that would be the B12, which she's already doing, but she's going to add a sublingual B12. I mentioned the methyl folate and then the vitamin B6 in the pyridoxal 5-phosphate form. And that will help with the homework. Okay, so you have the same hungry at night problems too. Yeah, so the problem about if you don't eat enough at your dinner meal, so adding some extra protein or fat at your evening meal will often help to curtail that hunger at night. But if you do have a blood sugar imbalance, then that can cause it too. So when you get hungry after a meal and you're hungry specifically for sweets, it may indicate blood sugar. And in your case, you might want to look at measuring your own blood sugar. I know Maura has been doing her blood sugar, and she seems to be, she was keeping it pretty stable, but she may want to look back at that. Homocysteine in relation to thyroid, I don't know that I was mentioning it specifically other than indirectly through the B12, B6, and folic acid. So if you recall me saying something otherwise, let me know that, Maura.
I think I'm just confused about something about ferritin. You said something mm-hmm. about ferritin and B12 and folic acid.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? What's the connection between having too much ferritin and B12 and liver problems or...
Okay, there's not really, so the connection might be the liver, but really what I was mentioning is that when you look at the RDW, it's giving you an indication that there's some sort of anemia going on. The anemia can be an iron deficiency anemia, or it can be a B12 folic acid B6 kind of an anemia. In Maura's case, we didn't have an iron level, but we did have her ferritin, and her ferritin was hefty. It was strong without being too strong. So I'm not suspicious of the iron, although I usually do like to do an iron and a ferritin, because what I want to do is see how well your body is doing the conversion. And sometimes when there's a mismatch, for example, somebody has a good ferritin level but a really low blood iron level, then that would say that there's something happening in the liver that is not allowing the stored ferritin to be put into the blood. The opposite can happen too. Somebody could have a really high level of iron but a very low ferritin, and it means it's over converting the iron out of its storage form and putting it into the blood. So that would indicate that there was some liver. We need to address the liver. And then as far as the B12 folic acid, that's independent. One causes a macrocytic anemia, one causes a microcytic anemia. But if you have both an iron deficiency and a B12 deficiency, say, superimposed, you might see a normal MCV and think the person's normal. So I was really, that whole conversation was really outlining the importance of RDW. And when I first learned looking at blood, people would just like overlook the RDW as anything important. And when I started to really look at what it meant, and I started to really analyze it on people's labs, I recognized that it was really an important piece to be looking at. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, but as far as, what would I want to say here? What actually causes the conversion in the liver? What do you need? Certain vitamins to do that or enzymes?
I have to go look up that pathway. I don't have that one memorized. But
okay.
Oftentimes when there's some sluggishness, when the liver is just not functioning at optimal, you'll see that. You'll also see some elevated lipid levels, extra LDL and low HDL.
Okay.
So it's just it's saying let's look at the liver. And I'd have to look up that particular biochemical pathway of ferritin to iron conversion to see what's required for it. Michaeline may know more about that because she was dealing with an elevated mic level. I can open up her mic and see if she recalls what nutrients might be required. Michaeline, do you have any more information about that, like what the nutrients are or pathways that are required for storing and releasing ferritin?
Yeah, the lactoferrin
mm-hmm.
For binding the excess iron.
Okay, so lactoferrin. So if somebody has high iron, or if they have high lactoferrin, they're going to bind more of their iron and it won't be available? Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is supposedly the lactoferrin helps bind the iron so that the ferritin will move out of storage into the use.
Okay. So it'll trick the body pretty much into thinking that the iron level is low because you're binding it up and cause more of the stored ferritin to be released.
Right.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Now, does B12 deficiency have anything to do with, what was I going to say? You were saying something one time about intrinsic factor
mm-hmm.
in B12.
Yeah.
Okay, that just helps you absorb. But that has nothing to do with the liver.
Right.
But it
no.
has nothing to do with the liver.
No, that's stomach.
Okay. Okay,
yeah.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, that's it.
Great. Great questions. Yeah, thank you.